Good morning from 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. Now, welcome to our election special candidates forum. As each Saturday this month, we speak to one candidate running for local or state office. The program is brought to you with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First and Main. Now, here are your hosts, Bob McAdams and Jeff Leonard.
Good morning. I'm Jeff Leonard, general manager of 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
And I'm Bob McAdams, special events coordinator at WPVC.
Today we're co-hosting a WPVC election special with one of our interviews with candidates for Charlottesville City Council. WPVC does not endorse any candidate for public office. We provide this information to you, our listeners, to help you choose the best candidate.
With us in the studio this morning is City Council candidate Lloyd Snook. Lloyd, welcome back to WPVC.
Glad to be here.
Lloyd, well, to help any listeners who have not been following the City Council race, let's start by getting to know a little bit about you. Briefly, where were you born and what was your life like as you were growing up?
I was born in New Jersey. My father worked for Standard Oil of New Jersey in New York City, commuting into the city. Then in 1961, the family decided, Dad decided to come down to what was then simply the business school, now the Darden School, and he became a professor in the Darden School. So I got down here when I was 8. I went to Venable. I went to Walker when it opened. I went to Lane High School, graduated from Lane High School in 1970. Went off to Stanford, spent 4 years there, got a degree in economics, and worked a couple of years as an investment analyst. Decided that I did not get my jollies out of making rich people richer. And so I went to law school and got married the day after we graduated. My wife is also a fellow UVA, University of Michigan alumna of the law school, graduated May 12th, 1979, got married May 13th, 1979, moved back to Charlottesville, and we've been here for the last 40 years.
How have your education and work background prepared you to serve as a member of City Council?
Well, of course, having a law degree, having an economics degree, and hopefully some knowledge in those two areas, economics and law are both important things of what goes on City Council. I also like to point out, though, that I am not going to be the lawyer for City Council. I will be a lawyer on City Council. But we have a city attorney and a very competent city attorney. So I'm not ever going to be in a situation where I'm going to be trying to be the lawyer. But that educational background, you know, I'm used to looking at proposals, ordinances and so on, and sort of fly-specking them is what I do as a lawyer, and say, wait a minute, that language doesn't make sense. Let's tighten this up. Let's tighten that up. And so you may find me as a counselor being sometimes a little bit picky about some of the language being used and hopefully trying to make sure that it actually means what it says.
I think the city attorney's office is busy enough, don't you think?
Yeah, they've got a lot to do, but I'm sure that we'll be giving them more to do.
I am sure. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, Charlottesville City Council Candidate Forum. I'm Jeff Leonard. With us in studio today is Lloyd Snook. Lloyd, how have you been active in recent years to help improve Charlottesville?
Well, when I moved back here in 1979, I quickly got involved in a lot of things, including being on the Planning Commission. I was on the Planning Commission from 1981 to 1989. Including a couple of years as chair. I ran for City Council for the nomination, for the Democratic nomination in 1990, and did not get it. David Toscano and Kay Slaughter beat me by 2 votes in the convention process. So I instead got to spend the decade of the 1990s being a dad, being a little league coach, a softball coach, a soccer coach, a Cub Scout leader, Boy Scout leader, president of the PTO, all that kind of stuff. After that, and all along, I've been, of course, continuing to practice law, doing a lot of work on criminal justice issues, opposing the death penalty, being involved in nonprofits like and doing legal work for nonprofits like MACA, like Habitat for Humanity, Offender Aid and Restoration. Over the years, I've served on the boards of the Community Energy Conservation Program, Madison House, Piedmont Housing Alliance, Ready Kids. I've got some pretty direct experience with most of the issues that we're going to be confronting on council in the next 4 years, like affordable housing, like the achievement gap in the schools and reading readiness for the kids, like reforming police practices, energy conservation, climate change.
You know, running for city council is a big deal. I've spent some time with you and some of your co-campaigners. You guys were exhausted at the end of the primary campaign, or at least it took a lot out of you, it appears. What lessons can you share from that experience? What did you learn?
Well, in the primary process, we had something like 15 forums and sometimes two a week. And it got to the point where, I could have given you Michael Payne's stump speech. I could have given you Cena McGill's stump speech.
I think I'd you guys should so have often. Just reversed roles one at a time and just gone up as Cena or Michael or somebody. Yeah.
But in terms of what I learned a few things. First of all, a lesson that I kept coming back to was don't endorse a position until you've studied it in detail. We got asked, will you endorse this proposal? In some cases, it was a proposal that was only half formed. It was never really put down in writing. We were asked, as an example, to endorse a specific proposal for the Civilian Review Board for the police. And it turned out that the proposal that I was looking at was not the proposal that they really wanted to comment on. And so I wound up giving an opinion about an entirely different set of proposals. Or there was a proposal for, please endorse the Charlottesville Low Income Housing Coalition's position on affordable housing, but they didn't tell us what that position was. And I got into some trouble with some of my progressive colleagues because I would say, I'm not endorsing something unless I've read it, unless you've given it to me. And that's an important lesson, I think, for anybody in politics. Second notion, other people have good ideas, too. There are a lot of different things, for example, that we can do to create more affordable housing. I've got a couple of ideas. Cena McGill has a couple of ideas. Michael Payne has a couple of ideas. We're probably going to need to do them all. Climate change, same thing. We don't have to just choose one or two. Another lesson, just because you think it doesn't mean you should say it. James Carville once talked about Joe Biden and said he has not yet learned the glory of the unspoken thought.
I think that is absolutely true.
And I hope that I have learned that a little bit. And finally, you don't have to join every fight that you're invited to.
Yeah, I think some other council candidates might need to learn from that lesson. It's hard when people who you want to support and you want to see do well ask you to endorse policies or things that you really haven't seen or they don't have completely fleshed out, and you've got to go just pure on speculation or faith that they're going to say the right thing.
Well, the Civilian Review Board proposal that we were told going into this forum at the end of April, we were going to be asked for our opinion on the proposal. And I kept trying to find a copy of the proposal, and the only copy that I could find was a copy. There were two copies I could find. The one I was supposed to comment on was the one that said, incomplete working draft, not for quotation or citation. And that's what they wanted. I didn't realize that's what they wanted comments on. Anyway, that's the kind of thing that people get caught up in the middle of the campaign. The other thing I've got that I have learned, or that I shouldn't say I've learned, I've always known it, I just don't do it, is that I've got to budget my time more carefully so I can occasionally get some sleep.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC City Council Candidate Forum. I'm Bob McAdams. And with us in the studio today is Lloyd Snook. Lloyd, the events of 2017, including the debate and vote on the statues, the July 8th KKK rally, the Unite the Right rallies on August 11th and 12th, plus all that followed, traumatized our community. We've now passed the second anniversary of those events. Where do you think we are in race relations in Charlottesville, and where are we headed?
I think there's a much more wide-open conversation that we're having now than we had 3 years ago. And it's not just a black versus white or black and white conversation, but there are so many different shades of conversation and angles coming from the black community, coming from the white community. Some of this is due to the post-August 12th discussions very specifically. Some of it's due to other factors that Charlottesville is just now kind of catching up to. For example, Richard Rothstein wrote a book a few years ago called The Color of Law, in which he documented the history of race discrimination in housing in much more depth than had really been put together in one place that I'd ever read. And we have people in Charlottesville who are bringing that research technique to Charlottesville to update it, to bring it local. And we're learning a lot more about how Charlottesville kind of developed and some of the racist policies behind how Charlottesville developed. And that's going to provoke some soul searching in ways that I haven't quite figured out yet. And I think we as a community are going to have to figure out. For example, we know one of the most important New Deal programs is the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA, was basically prohibited from making loans to African Americans from its inception in 1934 until actually the Kennedy administration tried to change that in about 1962, but nobody seemed to notice it. It wasn't until 1968 when the Fair Housing Act was passed that there was really a significant change. But during that time, that 35-year period, FHA was basically prohibited from making loans to African Americans or to builders who would sell to African Americans. And the result is that African Americans were largely excluded from one of the primary ways in which Americans build wealth. For decades after the U.S. Supreme Court declared that to be unconstitutional, we kept applying that law. Now that we understand that, what do we do with that understanding? There's been a lot of discussion about what do we do with that? As we identify more and more of these patterns, we'll keep coming back to the uncomfortable question, what do we do now? And I don't know what the answer is, but that's what the conversation is going to be over.
So, Lloyd, do you think one of the criticisms I have about the criticism is a hard word, but it seems to me like when we talk about race relations in Charlottesville, we just keep talking past each other. Do you think that's the case, and do you think we're coming to a point when we can actually sit down and have someone we're talking with understand that we're trying to come to this discussion from a good place, or are we still trying to process our anger?
I think there's a lot of still processing the anger. The other problem, you know, I was involved with civil rights issues in Charlottesville back in the 1960s as a high school student, and I've seen a lot of changes in the way in which we have discussed these kinds of things. There are within the liberal community or the left-leaning community or the Democratic Party community, there are a wide variety of responses, and some of the responses truly are talking past some of the other responses. And only some of the groups are engaging with only some of the groups. And I don't know exactly how we go about trying to get the most disaffected people, the people who are most angry, the people who are in many cases most hurt, literally, by the incidents on August 11th and 12th. It's hard to get them necessarily to see issues the same way that some of the rest of us do, who may be somewhat more detached, and it may be hard for those of us who are somewhat more detached to see the issues the same way as the people who were most intensely affected. One of the people who is an interesting bridge there is Sina McGill, because, of course, her husband was hurt on August 12th, on August 11th by the Nazis around the Jefferson statue down by the university, and had a stroke a couple days later. And so although she wasn't personally present during some of this stuff, she represents sort of a bridge between the people who were very directly impacted and those who are not. So I think there are people who are involved in the conversation who may be able to help us move closer together.
Well, thanks.
The events in Charlottesville on August 11th and 12th showed the overt racism of white supremacists. Now, recent acts of domestic terrorism in El Paso, Gilroy, Dayton, and attempted acts that they've been stopped by law enforcement, they all add proof to the Southern Poverty Law Center reports of a rapid increase in the number of hate groups over the past 2 years. How should a city like Charlottesville respond to this problem?
I think we can't talk about the future responses without at least acknowledging the past responses and acknowledging what did and didn't happen on August 11th and August 12th. We had a lot of management failures on August 11th and August 12th that have been well documented by folks like Tim Hafey. Personally, on August 11th, I was at St. Paul's Memorial Church the night that the church service was going on while the Nazis were across the street and with their tiki torches at the rotunda. I was one of the ushers who was telling people, no, you can't go outside now. The cops are telling us it's not safe for you to go outside. So I felt that kind of personally. August 12th, I was down at the Methodist Church during everything, wasn't out in the streets. But what we saw on August 11th and August 12th and the lead up to August 11th and August 12th was that Charlottesville did not distinguish between two different things. One is a First Amendment problem of free speech, the law school kind of problem. And the other is a Second Amendment problem that's really a law enforcement issue, not a law school issue. And all during the time, all during the lead up to August 12th, we had people in city government who were continuing to look at it as, well, this is a law school problem, and this is what the First Amendment tells us, when I and others were trying to tell the city, no, look at the tweets, look at the Facebook posts, look at everything that these folks are doing. They're not coming here to engage in an intellectual exercise. They're coming here to fight. And the city didn't get that. And so we have to make sure that we understand very completely. I mean, I'm on the one hand a very much an ACLU card-carrying libertarian free speech person, where I firmly believe, first of all, I don't like regulation of hate speech. That puts me firmly in the crosshairs of some of my very liberal friends who say we need to have some kind of policy that allows us to keep out speech we don't like. I don't think we can do that. The First Amendment has to be content neutral, and I believe that very firmly. Some of my more liberal friends want us to ban speech that makes women or minorities feel uncomfortable, but want us to permit speech that makes conservatives and Trump supporters feel uncomfortable. Can't do that. So I joined the basic ACLU position that the cure for bad speech is good speech. It is more speech. It is not censoring speech. And so we have to understand that First Amendment issue. On the other hand, we have to be absolutely careful that anything that is a true threat gets met not as a law school problem, but as a law enforcement problem. And so everything that happened on August 12th, for example, I mean, I still don't know what happened on August 12th. I think I know what happened on August 12th. I have my own theories about who's to blame for what. It doesn't really matter at this point, but what matters is that if they ever try to do this again, we need to understand that it's a law enforcement problem and it's not a free speech problem.
Now, the white supremacists in Charlottesville in August of 2017, they came armed with handguns and assault rifles. Only one handgun was fired on August 12th, but gun violence takes the lives of Virginians every day. After the Virginia Beach mass shooting, Governor Northam called a special session of the General Assembly to address gun violence to be held on July 9th. The General Assembly failed to do so. For what gun legislation do you think the city should lobby the General Assembly?
Well, and I would distinguish between two different things we're talking about here. One is the notion of gun legislation that we, as just sort of public-spirited citizens of a left-leaning bent, would like to see enacted. For example, to have some limit on size of magazines is an easy one. There's nothing that is specifically Charlottesville about that position. So I'm not sure that I want to have the Charlottesville City Council, per se, weighing in on every single issue that might possibly be of some interest to liberals. On the other hand, there are some specific things that came out of our experience in 2017 that have prompted some calls for some specific legislative changes. The first is that I think we need to amend. There's a statute, section 18.2-287.4, that allows certain localities to regulate large capacity weapons. To regulate shotguns that have more than 7 cartridges, I think, at a time, to regulate like AR-15s with more than 20, I believe it is, bullets at a time. There are many localities in the city, in the state, that have the power to do that. We have asked that Charlottesville be added to that list, but the city council the last couple of years hasn't really gotten its act together as far as a legislative agenda, so that hasn't gotten pushed forward. Second, I think we should repeal the statute, or seek repeal of the statute, that prohibits the city from banning firearms from demonstrations or situations where a state of emergency has been declared. That was added to the statutes about a decade ago by people who were upset seeing what happened with Hurricane Katrina, where the white folks were basically being told, no, you can't arm yourself to keep black people out of your community when the black communities have been flooded. And that was the Republican response, was to say, gee, we can't allow people to limit our ability to protect ourselves. That's nuts. That ought to get changed. Third, we should seek the repeal of Virginia Code Section 15.2-915 that prohibits localities from adopting any gun control laws at all. I'm not saying we ought to be adopting extensive gun control laws, but the notion that we can't even think about it is ridiculous. On top of that, there are some specific tweaks that I think ought to get made to the statutes that deal with declaration of emergency and declarations of unlawful assembly. When the violence began at about 10:30 on August 12th, it took about 45 minutes before it was clear whether we were going to be getting a declaration of a state of emergency from the governor and the state police, or whether we were going to get a declaration of an unlawful assembly that could have been a local decision. We had finger pointing for about 45 minutes there, during which a number of people were hurt and a number of bad things happened during that time. So that ought to get clarified.
And those 45 minutes made Charlottesville famous as that was broadcast around the world.
Right. Those are the pictures that went worldwide about what Charlottesville is all about. And when you talk about what Charlottesville is all about, you see people in masks and shields fighting it out in the middle of Market Street.
You know, many groups from Charlottesville, people from Charlottesville, have called for more affordable housing, me being one of them, which brings up a related concern about racial bias in zoning and gentrification. This year, Charlottesville is investing millions of dollars in public housing. What further actions do you think the city should take, and are you on board with the Living Wage campaign in and around Charlottesville?
Well, I am on board with the Living Wage campaign. There are two pieces to affordable housing. One is housing, and the other is affordable. And affordable becomes affordable if people get paid more. So you make housing affordable by lifting wages. So, I'm absolutely on board with that. There's a limit, perhaps, to what the city as city council can do, given the Dillon Rule and so on. But one of the things we can do and we should do is there's a specific problem when the city gives construction contracts to contractors who then contract for their labor with subs that don't pay a living wage or who pay their workers under the table or pay on a 1099 basis instead of providing benefits and Social Security. We need to look at how city procurement people can monitor those contracts to prevent that sort of wage theft. But as far as the other question you had about affordable housing, that's been the largest topic that we've talked about the most so far this year. And I'll give you the nutshell version. We need about 3,000 more affordable units in the city, probably 10,000 more affordable units in the county. Supply is the problem, and the expense is the problem, in part because anybody who lives close to the university is paying a big locational premium for being close to the university. And it used to be that you could live in 10th and Page and walk to your job at the hospital. No longer, because now the people at the hospital aren't getting paid enough to live that close to the university. So we've got a lot of work that's got to get done here. Some of that is going to happen when we redevelop public housing projects. For example, we're going to redevelop South First Street. There's a proposal to add another 300 units or so there. We'll get another 300 units from the redevelopment of Friendship Court. There's some things we can be doing with the auxiliary dwelling unit process to make those easier to get. That may get us another 500 units. There are some discussions about form-based code that may allow for duplexes and triplexes and so on in some places that are currently single-family zones. I am not a fan of a broad rezoning and changing everything, eliminating all R1 zoning. But there are some tweaks we can make there that I think would add some more units. Finally, we've got to recognize it's a regional problem. It's a problem that Albemarle County has also. And the solution we have is going to have to be a regional solution. It's going to have to involve building more, and it's not likely to involve building in the city because there's just not a lot of room in the city. But it's going to involve buses, and it's going to involve allowing people to live in the county and take a good bus system into their job at the university or to downtown Charlottesville. If the university were to follow through on their talked-about plans to build more student housing, that would be an enormous benefit.
Yeah, it's a problem of success rather than a problem of failure. The success is that Charlottesville is a thriving community where people want to live and move back into, thus uprooting the low wealth and low income individuals. So it's I don't want to say it's a good problem to have, but it's a problem that success brings.
Well, and the real problem is that just about everything that you do economically has two sides to it. And so, for example, if you end up, let's say you improve a neighborhood, you fix up some slum property. Now you've raised everybody's property values in the area. Now their taxes go up, and now the old folks get forced out. Now we have gentrification. So every good thing has a bad thing with it, and there's no simple answer.
That is true. The recent report on SOL score shows again that the achievement gap between the races in Charlottesville City schools, there is an achievement gap. The school division is implementing a new approach to address this problem. What can other city departments do to help students learn?
Well, by law, we can't interfere with how the schools handle the 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. portion of the day. But when the kids come home from school to the Salvation Army because the family is homeless, or when they're coming back to a home with no food in it, or to parents who can't themselves read, there are things there that the city can do. We've had some success with the City of Promise program, helping kids in the West Haven and Star Hill neighborhoods. I'd like to see us expand those programs to other areas that have a lot of at-risk kids, you know, the South First neighborhood, the Friendship Court neighborhood, for example. Beyond that, of course, the school board wants the city to spend up to about $80 million to reorganize the schools, move the pre-Ks to Walker Elementary, Walker Upper Elementary, put the fifth grades back in local elementary schools, have Buford be the sixth, seventh, and eighth grades. I'm not sure that $80 million to do that is going to lift anybody's reading scores, but that's a discussion we've got to have, because $80 million has got to come from the city council. It's not going to come from the school board.
No, indeed. All right, thanks, Lloyd. It's a great discussion. We need to take a short break. And we're back. I'm Jeff Leonard. I'm co-hosting with Bob McAdams, the 94.7 WPVC election special interview with City Council candidate Lloyd Snook. Bob and Lloyd, we're talking about the issues.
And the issues don't get any easier. Having health care available when you need it is a necessity for all people in our area. And lowering the high cost of health insurance is another need for many people in the city. What role do you see the city taking to address the real concern of people receiving health care when they need it?
Well, I'm going to duck this question, and I think this problem is really above council's head. It's not really something council can do much about. The insurance marketplace is regulated by federal and state government. I have a hard time seeing what the city can actually do. The problem is not the problem here is not that there are no doctors. That is the problem in some other areas. Some counties in Virginia, for example, have no doctors, or they have no OBGYNs. That's an issue at a time where, in some cases, the county will go and create a clinic where they're going to bring the doctors in. We don't have that problem. We have loads of doctors. We just don't have the ability to get health insurance to pay the doctors for people who don't have jobs with health insurance. I don't see a way that it makes much sense for local governments to try to fill that gap.
Getting care for mental illness is even more of a challenge. There are limits to insurance coverage, but there's a lack of professionals in the field, and that means that many people with many health problems, they just go untreated. What should the city do to help people with mental illness receive the care they need?
Well, unfortunately, right now, a lot of those people are receiving their mental health care at the Albemarle-Charlottesville Regional Jail. You know, that's the largest mental health facility in our community right now, and that's nuts. We need to have other ways, whether it's through the criminal process, through family treatment courts, through drug courts, things like that, ways of diverting people away from getting their mental health treatment over on Avon Street. The city can do things like the drug court, mental health docket, and so on. Right now, we give millions of dollars a year to Region 10 mental health every year. That needs to continue. I don't have any specific proposals in mind for specific gaps that need to be filled or that the city can profitably fill. I want to keep in mind that there are some things that cities do well and some things that cities don't do well. And one of the things I don't think we would do well is to try to immerse ourselves too much in the details of any kinds of programs like that. If there's a program where we can write a check, that's going to have to be developed by somebody else. They're going to have to justify it, and then we can talk about it.
All right, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, Charlottesville City Council candidate forum. I'm Jeff Leonard. In studio today is our friend Lloyd Snook. Lloyd, you touched on this in your last answer, but you and I have been on the front lines of fighting the mashup of mental illness and the criminal justice system for probably three decades. The superintendent from the local jail, the regional jail, Martin Coomer, who is a great guy, he says 50% of the people in jail suffer from some sort of mental illness and 80% have substance abuse problems. What changes in our criminal justice system need to occur to address these inequities and these needs?
Well, first of all, again, let's recognize this is not usually a city council kind of a problem, except to the extent that we may be called upon to write a check. But first, we need more emphasis on drug treatment rather than drug incarceration. And that is an emphasis that I think the courts and the prosecutors have to a large extent endorsed in recent years. So we're in the right direction there. More use of a mental health court as an alternative to standard prosecutions and incarcerations. Continue the work that Chief Brackney has been doing to reorganize and restaff the city police department. Use the civilian review board process to investigate discriminatory police practices as a way to help rebuild some sense of trust between the police department and the African-American community in particular. Those are the kinds of things that I think the city can do, the city council can do. As I said, there are a lot of other decision makers that we don't have control over. One thing that people coming to protest to city council sometimes don't want to hear is, we have no say over what the courts do. We have no say over what the Commonwealth's attorney does. We can't, for example, when people were coming and saying to city council that city council needed to drop the charges against DeAndre Harris, city council had no say over that. It would be unconstitutional for us to try to go to the Commonwealth's attorney or the court to say this is what ought to happen. So let's keep clearly in mind what we can do. Let's do what we can do. But in many cases, what we can do is write a check.
So I would agree, but statistics reveal that in the criminal justice system, there is systemic racism from police stops to prosecutions to incarcerations. People that look like me have a clear advantage over people of color. You know, what can city council do? Because largely you guys would be the face of the city. What can you do to make sure all the members in our community feel that justice is equally administered by our police officers, prosecutors? And what can you guys do and ladies do to make sure that the community feels like, one, they're being heard, and two, they're being treated fairly by the police and the criminal justice system?
Well, I think one of the things that we need to do is to make sure that there are ways to be heard, places to be heard. When the only time that they have, that anybody has to make a public comment is on Monday night at 6:30, Monday night at 6:30 becomes a very different place. And so one of the purposes of the Civilian Review Board is to allow people who have issues with the police department to take those issues to somebody that might have some authority to do something about them, to investigate them, whatever. The Civilian Review Board process, as I've had some criticisms about the way that it got to where it's gotten to, but I think that the proposal that is currently being made is overall a pretty good proposal, and I would like to see that proposal get adopted by council. Not 100% sure I'm on board with all of the money that they want, but they're going to clearly have to have some resources. But that's a way, I think, that if we have more involvement at the Civilian Review Board, for example, we can talk about at that point. What I've suggested all along is that the Civilian Review Board could look at a couple of what I think are abusive police practices, and perhaps get the police chief to say to the police officers, "Stop doing this stuff." Give you an example: the cop stops a black guy on the street, stops a black guy in a car, and says, "I smell marijuana." Under Virginia law, that's sufficient for him to search the car. I can't tell you how many times
they smell a lot. They smell a lot of marijuana.
Smell a lot of marijuana. I had a case where the guy who's there with a drug dog, he says, "I smell marijuana." He doesn't bring the drug dog to come check for marijuana. The cop searches the car, does not find marijuana, by the way, but does find some other things that shouldn't have been there. So. But that's the kind of exercise of discretion that we allow police officers to exercise that the courts won't intervene in. But the police chief can. The police chief can say to the people who work for her, "Don't do this stuff." That's what ought to be happening.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, Charlottesville City Council candidate forum. I'm Bob McAdams. Lloyd, recent reports from scientists tell us that the climate change crisis is much worse than previously understood. Record heat in Europe and melting glaciers in Greenland and Category 5 hurricanes show the urgent need for action. How should Charlottesville respond to the worsening global warming crisis?
You're talking about melting glaciers in our 51st state? Greenland. City Council has already set an ambitious goal of having the city as a whole be carbon neutral by 2050, and with a goal to reduce carbon emissions by 45% by 2030. 2030 is not very far away. You know, it's 11 years away. The detailed plans haven't yet been drawn up, but I'm encouraged by the fact that we have a potentially measurable goal with potentially measurable benchmarks so that we can know whether we're making some progress. Some specific suggestions, big one, urban planning and design that is less car-centric, more and smaller electric buses running often enough to encourage people to get out of their cars and into buses. Right now, nobody's going to take a bus when you've got an hour between buses. It just becomes too difficult to coordinate your travel. But if you get the headway down to, say, 15 minutes, that's the point at which studies show people begin to use bus services. Some sort of almost gimmicky kinds of things, but they add up. LED streetlights, my estimation is we could save $100,000 a year in both energy and maintenance costs. We can use the gas and water utilities to encourage more energy efficiency in the home, more tolerance for solar panels on flat roofs. So we got the city buildings have a lot of flat roofs, could be having solar panels. Again, transportation planning that emphasizes bikeability and walkability. Those are the kinds of things. But there's an interesting study done recently by the UN that found the proposal that would make the biggest difference to cutting greenhouse gases is to manage refrigeration chemicals. That's something that if we could figure out a way, management of refrigeration chemicals to change all cooling systems and refrigerant systems to use cleaner non-greenhouse gas chemicals, building a market, the city could help build a market and infrastructure to make it easier for citizens to switch. The second proposal that the UN came up with was the use of more onshore wind turbines. Now, Charlottesville is not really a wind capital the way some places are, but I imagine we could find ways to incorporate wind turbines and into some of our city land uses in a way that could contribute some energy. There are things like that that we need to do, and it's going to take a lot of thought to get us to 45% reduction in 11 years.
A growing population is increasing the need for city services and infrastructure as well. How does the city manage both the climate crisis and the demands from growth?
Well, one of the good things about a lot of the demand for growth at this point, I mean, when you're building new, you can build energy efficiency in. And so we have the opportunity, for example, in some of the major projects that are being built and going to be built in coming years, we have the power to insist, even at a site plan level, on greater energy efficiency, and we can do some of that. But the really important thing is we've got to get some meaningful transportation planning as a part of a regional transportation program. You know, we have 30,000 people who work at the University of Virginia. We can't possibly have, and it's only going to go up, we can't possibly have 30,000 people coming in individual cars every day. They've got to come in buses or walk or carpool or something. That's going to have to increase. We need to spend more time thinking about that. We also need to understand that if the proposals to turn downtown Charlottesville into a high-tech hub come to pass, we're going to have perhaps 1,000 or 2,000 more employees downtown. Where are they going to park? They're not. We're going to have buses for them. That's going to help with some of the carbon neutrality.
Yeah, but we're also going to build a parking lot where Lucky 7 and my favorite Guadalajara is downtown, which is frustrating. So Lloyd, future trends point to higher population density in urban areas, as we discussed that we need to with the affordable housing crunch. Studies of practical experience show that humans need green space for their well-being and to keep a community sane. How do you think we can, as a city, balance these needs?
Well, first thing is we need to make sure we preserve the green spaces we have now. The McIntyre Botanical Garden is going to be a major asset in coming years, I think. We have opportunities through special use permits and planned unit developments to require green spaces in some of these developments, and we should insist on them. In the strategic investment area, for example, the proposals that are floating around Friendship Court and the Ix Park and all of that section of town, we've got to make sure that when that gets developed, that we keep parkland, that we keep green space. Unfortunately, one of the things that will go away with the redevelopment of Friendship Court is some of the green space there, and then we need to figure out how we're going to increase the amount of green space. We can also finish the greenway around the city. finishing it through McIntyre, through Greenbrier Park, for example, and find ways to get our residents out into the parks.
You know, everyone has their ideas about what major projects the city can do, and we've touched on several of them. The next question that a lot of times gets overlooked is, from what sources of revenue can the city get the funds for all of these projects that are worthy of consideration?
Well, we have huge demands for money to be spent on affordable housing programs. Fortunately, a lot of that money we're going to be able to get through low-income housing tax credits. There are plans out there and programs out there to bring outside money in to solve those problems, but there are no such plans for how we're going to do the school renovations, for example. That's money we're going to have to generate from tax revenues. And I've got some other things we've talked about, bus systems and things like that, that are going to cost some money. In the last 5 years or so, decisions at the council level have resulted in our losing tax revenues from a host of major projects. Developers will tell you that council has nixed proposals that could be generating $6 million a year in tax revenues by now. I'm talking about the Dewberry Hotel. I'm talking about Keith Woodard's building to house the city market, building of high-end condos that would have gone up at the corner of 2nd and Water, just as examples. We need to embrace that kind of investment, even if it favors some rich people, because we can use that money to help the schools and energy conservation and other efforts. I want to, in the words of George W. Bush, grow the pie higher.
We need to take a short break. Thanks, Lloyd. And we're back. I'm Jeff Leonard. I'm co-hosting with my friend Bob McAdams, a 94.7 WPVC election special with City Council candidate Lloyd Snook. Bob and Lloyd, we got one more segment. Let's get to the issues.
Lloyd, we all know from experience that trust is essential for human interactions to work. In Charlottesville, after the turmoil of 2017, trust broke down. In January of 2020, City Council will have three new members. What will you do, what should City Council do, to build trust between city government and the people of Charlottesville?
Well, first, let me be clear. I hope to be one of five who will be trying to turn this around. This is not a Donald Trump thing. I alone can fix this. I cannot alone fix this. But I hope that with Michael Payne, Sina McGill, as well as working with Heather Hill and Nakia Walker, that we can make some changes. We'll have a new city manager. We have a new city manager. We have a new city attorney, a new police chief, new HR director. We'll have all new counselors. Last December, council had a retreat at which they basically agreed they didn't like each other. They didn't trust each other. They couldn't even agree that the others were all acting from a belief in what they thought was best for the city. We'll have to try to reset those relationships among counselors. Then we have to get out into the communities and meet our constituents, not just at council meetings on Monday nights, if we're going to have any chance of getting some sense of let's have Monday nights be doing council business. It can't be the only time in the week or in the month that there is an opportunity for engagement with the public. Finally, we need to be able, as individuals and as a council, to listen to understand people, not just listen to respond.
Trust between police officers and members of the community must be there to keep the city safe, and we've talked about this a bit. On July 2nd, the Interim Police Civilian Review Board presented to City Council draft plans for a permanent civilian review board. They have some recommendations in terms of staff. What do you see as the role of that board in building trust, and what authority should it have?
Well, the main role that it serves, I think, is to provide the situation, to be an ombudsman, basically, to be a situation where people can bring their complaints and can be heard by some representative of city government. And hopefully there will be some inquiry after that. The catch is that there's a lot of inquiry that that folks are going to want that is not actually permitted by Virginia law. There will be tension between this, you know, how much Virginia law permits and how much people are going to want. And I predict that some people are going to feel frustrated because they don't get to, for example, have the civilian review board fire somebody. That's not what civilian review boards in Virginia, at least, are allowed to do. They are allowed to gather facts. They are allowed to present a report or reports to the police chief, to city council, to the city manager, whoever. And they are allowed to be the the way that an individual complaint can sort of be amplified and made it to where people have to pay attention to it and give it serious weight. That's what it needs to be trying to do. That's why I've said all along that I think that the real avenue for the Civilian Review Board is not to be trying to fire people, but to be going to the police chief saying, here's what we have discovered. Here's what you need to know the people that you serve are saying about your department. Here are the problem areas. That's what they can do. The current set of bylaws, I think, will allow them to do that, and I hope that the current set of bylaws or something fairly close to it gets approved by City Council.
I can only imagine when the consumers of the Civilian Review Board come in and the person in charge tries to explain them the Garrity warnings that are given to police officers.
Right.
Which essentially, police officers have rights. They don't have to answer your questions.
Right. And if they do end up being forced to answer the question for some reason, that answer can never be used against them in any court.
It is.
And that's not what people want to hear.
No, there are landmines all over this. Speaking of that, trust is also necessary within the city government. How do you see the relationship between city council and city staff, led by the city manager, as they work to meet their mutual responsibility to serve the public?
Well, I've met Dr. Richardson. I've been very impressed with him so far. He knows city governance. He knows Virginia. He's got the academic background. He's got the experience background. I think he's going to be very effective for us in turning our ship around. Under Maurice Jones, my understanding from the councilors was that they didn't have confidence in his management, in his implementation, in his follow-through, which is why they often seem to be micromanaging from their council chairs, which they should not have been doing. In 2017 and 2018, the city had a number of efficiency studies done that pinpointed 83 different problems in upper management. I've suggested that council ask Dr. Richardson for an interim report after he's been here for 6 months, which would be about November, and just tell us which of those 83 problems are still problems. Personally, I will want Dr. Richardson to use those efficiency studies as basically his order of work to report back to council. If we can do that, then we can, and again, it's important that it's the city manager doing the work to manage the city and reporting to council. That's the appropriate relationship, not council trying to reach down into City Hall and make changes.
That is so true. The Charlottesville City Council is, you know, if someone's trash doesn't get picked up on 10th and Page, you don't call Public Works, you call a member of City Council. It's just.
Well, and to be fair, a couple weeks ago when we had the big storm that knocked down a lot of trees in Greenbrier, I wrote an email to council, largely because I had an email address for council, you know, right. council@charlottesville.org. And I got a response, sort of a snippy response from one of the counselors saying, you of all people should know that we were not going to get involved in this, and we have a policy to follow, and blah, blah, blah. I will note, there is not, in fact, as far as I can tell, there is not, in fact, a written policy. So when they tell me that there is a policy, that's hogwash. When they tell me that Greenbrier didn't meet the threshold for a free collection, but they can't tell me what that threshold is, there's not a policy. But I digress.
Greenbrier got hit pretty hard. In what areas do you think Charlottesville could best collaborate with Albemarle, UVA, and neighboring counties?
Well, I'm a big proponent of cooperation with the county and the university. Both of them have expressed an interest in energizing a regional transportation authority and in working together on affordable housing, which are regional problems. They are not only city problems. We recently made a deal with the county on co-locating the courts downtown. We need to keep pushing on that kind of cooperation. The county has insisted, for example, that we do certain things with parking. We've got to make sure we have follow-through on that. We have had agreements in the past where the city has not followed through on their promises on parking. We have to make sure that that continues. There's so many things we need to be doing to cooperate, but those are the primary ones.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's Charlottesville City Council Forum interview with Lloyd Snook. I'm Bob McAdams. Lloyd, you're running for city council. Now, how do you describe your candidacy, your campaign to voters, in a moment or two you might have with them at a door or in an elevator?
Well, I don't talk to a lot of people in elevators. So the notion of an elevator speech, I understand the concept. I do a lot of door-to-door stuff. I tell them I've lived in Charlottesville for most of my life, that I know Charlottesville and city government well. In the past year, I saw that Charlottesville was foundering. I decided that I wanted to use my experience in law, in nonprofits, in government to help Charlottesville get going in the right direction again so we can address problems like affordable housing and the achievement gap in schools and stopping climate change.
Now, the November 5th election is coming up quickly. I'm sure you're aware of that. What is your plan and what organization are you building to get your message out to the people of Charlottesville?
Well, along with Michael Payne and Sina McGill, the three of us were the winners in the Democratic primary. We'll be knocking on a lot of doors. We will be doing it sort of a lot of it jointly. You know, we'll have a lot of Democratic supporters who are supporting the entire ticket. Also, admittedly, there's some people who support only one of the candidates or maybe only two of the candidates, and they may be doing some other things. I suspect that I've got some friends, for example, I mean, I know I've got some friends, people who are high school classmates of mine, for example, who now live in the county, who don't really care about the other candidates, but they're going to be supporting me, and they will be knocking on doors for me. So we'll be doing a lot of door knocking. We'll hand out a lot of literature to the people we meet. We expect about 8,000 people will come vote. So that gives us a target universe that we've designated in terms of who are the kinds of people who are likely to show up at this kind of an election. We have a Charlottesville Democratic Committee of 100 members, and they will be working for the ticket as a whole. As far as my personal campaign, I ran a fair number of TV ads in the spring, and I imagine I'll be doing some of that again, probably doing other types of ads as well. There are some radio stations, I understand, that are willing to take...
Whatever you need. Whatever.
There'll be at least one or two mailings.
In your primary, you were sort of committed that you were running sort of by yourself because you said you had to work with whoever was elected and didn't want to have any allegiances at that time. But now you're running in a combined campaign. How is that? What do you think the differences are in that for you personally?
Well, first of all, when I was running in the primary, I did not say... I believe that I can honestly say this. I certainly tried to be able to say this. I never said a negative thing about anybody else with whom I might possibly be serving. And that includes current counselors with whom I might be serving. That includes any of the other, the primary opponents. Because I didn't want to burn bridges before I got into office. My particular style in all of this is I'm campaigning for the ticket, and I'm campaigning for all three of us. I know that there will be some people who won't, and there's some people and some of the other supporters don't like me for whatever reason. That's fine. I'm sure I've got some supporters who don't like either Sina or Michael for their own reason. That's fine. I'm going ahead. I personally am going to be working for the ticket, and Michael and Sina will be working for the ticket. What our supporters end up doing, that's up to them.
Yeah, it's hard to run and keep your supporters in line and from going off message because sometimes they say things that will probably want to make you
cringe.
Well,
and in fact, we've got the situation of I've got supporters and I know Michael's got supporters who clearly don't like each other.
Right, you guys were completely different primary campaigns, or very different primary campaigns. And to see you running together, it's as a spectator, it's fun to watch. And I like you, I like Michael, I like Sina very much, and I know you're good people, so you will definitely do the right thing.
The good news is we get along together pretty well, and we found during the forum process that we kind of stole each other's ideas as we went along. And for example, things I was talking about, like LED streetlights, kind of got worked into the stump speech by Sina and Michael, and things that that they were talking about, I kind of incorporated. And so I take some comfort from that we have enough respect for one another and our ideas that we seem to be working well together. And I think that bodes well for serving on council together.
Excellent. You know, every campaign has to pay for the basics to get your message out to as many people as possible. How are you raising money to pay for these basics?
Well, we just had a joint fundraiser, got about $4,000 out of that. We'll have some money coming from the city party. But the city party is basically funding maybe a mailing at the end of things, the get-out-the-vote efforts and so on. Other than that, I've got my yard signs. The expense is already paid for. That's fine. The only thing I'm going to have to pay for from here on out that I haven't already done is whatever new advertising I'm going to be doing. As an individual, I raised more money than any of my opponents. I had more donors of more than $100 than any of the rest of them. I also had more donors of less than $100 than any of them. I really haven't been doing any fundraising per se, but I do have a lot of friends who understand that political campaigns need money, and I hope my friends will continue to remember that.
You and I aren't dissimilar. Do you get lost in those campaign finance website? I spend hours on that thing just looking at who's giving what to whom and for how much. And
I haven't immersed myself as much recently, but I did very early on just to see. Okay, and of course, every time the new round of reports comes out, I kind of look to see, okay, that person gave me money, but they also gave money over here. You know, and it gets kind of interesting.
Yeah, trying to make sense of this year's political landscape is it's fun.
Yeah.
So what's the best way that people get in touch with you to learn more about you, volunteer, or even donate?
Well, the easiest way is just to go to my website, www.lloydsnookforcouncil.org, all one word. There's a link there to an Act Blue page, excuse me, for donations, as well as details on position issues on positions and so on. If you want a yard sign, you want a bumper sticker, you want to volunteer, you can send me a message. We'll get right back to you. So go through the website.
All right. Thanks, Lloyd. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. Lloyd, thank you so much for spending this hour with the WPVC listeners. This is one of our series of election special interviews with candidates for Charlottesville City Council. Each of the interviews will be available on podcast at our website, 947wpvc.org. We thank Lloyd for giving us his time so that you, our listeners, can make a best choice for you coming up for City Council. Next week, we welcome to the studio City Council candidate Bellamy Brown. He'll be here for his election interview. Thanks for listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
You've been listening to the 94.7 WPVC Election Special Candidates Forum. The program is brought to you with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First and Main. Join us again next Saturday at 11 as we talk to yet another candidate for local office in Virginia's 2019 off-year elections. You can hear this program again or suggest questions for upcoming guests at 947WPVC.org or link to it through our Facebook page. Thanks for listening.